Talk given Saturday, 8th April 1972. In some form or other, everyone grasps at immortality, craves for immortality. Or to put it in another form, is totally unwilling to let go of the entity ego. Mankind does not realize that this is a complete illusion. There is no such thing as immortality for the entity ego. And yet, all the religions of the world have taught immortality, provided there is realization by that person in the religious sense. The theistic religions teach an immortality after death in heaven or hell. Religions like Hinduism and Buddhism, which propound popularly the teaching of rebirth, promise an immortality at the end of the cycle of births and deaths. And all human beings, whatever their beliefs may be, or whatever they propound intellectually to themselves or profess to others, cling to the idea of personal immortality. Now, it is particularly interesting that Buddhism, which analyzes the existential living being, you or I, in terms of various aggregates, five aggregates usually, which are completely perishable, that in spite of that analysis, Buddhism also talks of immortality. Only the word that the Buddhist uses is deathlessness, which essentially means the same thing. As you all know, the first words of the Buddha, or among the very first words of the Buddha, after the enlightenment, to the five, were, "Hearken, bhikkhus, the deathless has been gained." That is how it is usually translated. And the Pali is, "Odahata bhikkhave sotam, amatam adhigatam aham anusasami." Odahata sotam means literally, "give ear, bhikkhave, O monks." Give ear. Sotam is hearing. Odahata means supply. So in English we would say, "give ear, O monks." Amatam, the deathless, adhigatam, usually translated, has been found or won, I would prefer to translate, has been supremely entered into. Adi, the topmost, supreme. Gatang means a going, an entering into. And I think it is important to notice that the word used is a word which denotes activity, a life process. It is not a word which denotes the ending of a movement or activity or effort. The deathless state is one into which there is a continuous entering. And he goes on to say that if you were to live thus and thus, you yourself, here and now in this life, will realize that supreme goal for the sake of which men leave home and enter homelessness. Put it in a slightly different form. Leave the family or the familiar life and enter into the homeless or the unknown life. I feel it is really important to get at these subtler tones and meanings which are involved in the original statements. Because if one gets them, I think one understands the reality of what is happening. So now, deathlessness is a state into which you are continuously entering. And note the emphasis, here and now in this life, whilst you are alive. There is no statement of anything after death. And how does one do that? And the Buddha expounds the usual teachings. Now, side by side with this, recall that other statement which he makes. And this is deathlessness, O Ananda, namely the complete cessation of all craving. And in other contexts where the Buddha talks about craving, he talks about craving for anything and everything, including nirvana or annihilation or anything you wish to mention. The complete cessation of all craving. This is deathlessness. And here is the statement of the supreme and continuous entering into the deathless state. And this is nirvana, this complete cessation of craving. There is absolutely no mention whatsoever of an entity, a continuing entity, which through time and space will enjoy nirvana. The whole idea of enjoyment, in our sense of the term, is out. What he does affirm is that that reality, that transcendent reality, is here and now when I, the existential being made up of the five heaps, the aggregates, have completely ceased to grasp, to crave. Now, if we can listen to this, or if we can look at the book and read the words, see the words, if we can listen or look in the perfect, the right way, there will be realization of the full significance and meaning of the teaching right now. You don't have to wait for the day when one's mind will be enlightened. Enlightenment is like the lightning flash. Only it's a lightning which stands still and lightens up forever. That is the difference. It's like the sun, ever shining. When I crave, when my consciousness spills over into what are commonly called the cankers, speculative ideas and discussions, the desire to become this, that and the other at different grades of development and so forth. When the desire for such and such enjoyments crops up, kama sava, all those are the states in which I am craving for something or other. And in those states, I am the one who is producing the clouds that obscure the sunlight of the enlightened state. So now, the question arises, do we or don't we crave? In actual fact, we all like a certain amount of comfort. We all want success. We all want happiness. We all want things to go the way we would like things to go. We are always wishing that this would not be this, but otherwise, with very rare exceptions. If we are going out for a picnic and we have a nice sunny day, with just a lovely cool breeze so that we won't get sunburnt, we don't wish it otherwise. But we crave for something else, namely that it will continue all the time that we are having our picnic. So you see, we jump into the mire either with the right foot or the left foot. We're always jumping into the mire. Wishing it to continue thus is just as much a craving as wishing it otherwise, craving for something else. Now, to whom is this craving, or to what, let me put it this way, to what central point of reference can we relate this craving? Obviously, the entity ego, however unconscious, It is everlastingly that entity, ego, which is the central point of reference of all desire, good or bad, of all states of mind, good or bad. The entity ego is the basic delusion. The self which is cut off from the not-self. At best, it may be slightly related to the not-self, but on the whole, it is unrelated to the not-self. Because if the self concept were a concept where one is entirely and wholly related to the not-self, so-called, then both self and not-self disappear, because they have no meaning in terms of separation. There is only the one total reality, supreme being, total being, which, as you will appreciate, is quite different from a supreme being. Because the moment you say a or the supreme being, there is the entity again, the separate cut-off entity. So now, you see, deep in our minds is this tremendous delusion of separate selfness, separate self-subsistence and existence. And it is for this separate self that we crave anything and everything, including the deathless state, immortal being. And as long as there is this craving for immortal being, for the separate entity, we are absolutely caught in the trap of delusion. But deathlessness immortality is real, wholly and totally real. The one total reality is deathless. It is immortal. It never was born, it never dies. It remains itself, not statically, but creatively. And this creativeness is an integrative creativeness all the time. You may remember some time ago, I used that phrase, eternity rides on the wings of time. And this creative activity of the one total reality is of such a nature that we, constituted as we are, and therefore limited as we are, can just perceive it only in terms of time. In the moment, or in those moments where there is the complete cessation of all grasping, of all craving, and the whole disorderliness and disturbance of the mind has calmed down, we are in that state of poise where we are completely in tune with this creative activity. And in that state, psychological time is in perfect rhythm with chronological time, and discriminative consciousness has completely given place to pure and total awareness. And this awareness is one with this creative process. It is one with this creative process, but remains unknowing in the discriminative sense of the creative process. Whensoever you experience this, after the experiencing, because you cannot know it discriminatively during the experiencing, but after the experiencing, the impress made upon the psychophysical organism is so profound that a process of memory of what happened starts up, and you are able to reconstruct intellectually. You make a thought picture of it. Reconstruct intellectually something of the nature of that realization. And it is that which gives the perfected Holy One the authority to affirm unequivocally that there is deathlessness, there is nirvana. But do remember, it is something which can never be attained, achieved, grasped. It happens. It is here now. It is in the eternal now, permanently, unchangingly. It is you or I who flits into that sunlight or drops back again behind the cloud. Mostly, we are the dropouts behind the clouds. You remember how time and again I have said the great teachers were concerned, supremely concerned for our happiness, for our fulfillment. But they knew the meaning of happiness. I don't know the meaning of happiness, I the ordinary man. I the ordinary man know pleasure, sensational delight, whether it be physical sensation or an aesthetic sensation or an intellectual sensation. That is not the thing which the Holy Ones were concerned with. Because they knew that this sensational delight of body or mind is an ephemeral thing. It passes away. And in its passing, it kicks back at me with the reaction of disappointment, sorrow, suffering, regret that it has gone away. The Buddha again and again says, be free of the hankering and the consequent dejection for all worldliness and worldly states. Be free of that altogether. And if one can be free of that altogether, then this inner reality of happiness is there. Because it is constitutive of mind. It is the very stuff of the mind. The mind in disturbance is unhappy. And because of ignorance, I seek to counteract that disturbance and that unhappy state by chasing a sensational pleasure, a sensational satisfaction, whatever it may be. This is where I make my mistake. I crave for it. But happiness, in the true sense, or to use the best word which all the religions have used, ananda, bliss, is something which can never be chased. Here am I alive, and here is the body. I don't have to chase a body. It is here. I am quite unconscious, in fact, that the body is here. It just is here, and I don't go seeking it. It is like that. Now, the holy ones were concerned for our happiness in that sense, because it meant the fulfillment, the complete fulfillment of that individual being by his arriving at the state where he was the unresisting medium, instrument, through which the one total reality realized the purpose of human existence. But it is the one total reality. It is transcendence, it is God, it is Brahman, it is Adi Buddha, use whatever word you like, which realizes, makes real. And it can make real only through all creation. It makes real certain qualities, certain wonderful things through the stone, through the diamond, through the pearl, through the flower, through the sun, the sunset and the sunrise, through the song of the bird, through you and through me. But whereas with all those others, the thing happens spontaneously because the stone doesn't resist the total reality, nor does the sunset, nor does the song of the bird. It just happens spontaneously, naturally, totally in accord with all the forces at play. But you and I have this extraordinary capacity to resist it, to have our own conceptions, which invariably, from the point of view of transcendence, are misconceptions. They are misconceptions because they are born of grasping, of craving, greed. This is the important point to bear in mind. The one who is without greed will also give forth conceptions. Take the Buddha himself. Take the great teachers, the great spiritual teachers. They gave out conceptions, if you like, formulated them in so many words. But you see, none of those conceptions came out of them as the result of their desire to achieve this, that, or the other. They were the natural, spontaneous, and the most perfect expression of their state of consciousness, their state of awareness, which was of the nature of the deathless, uncraving, allowing the becoming process to pass by unresisted. Therefore, themselves, being at the supreme level of intelligence, saw the truth of things as they passed by in the becoming process, and as the circumstance required, as those around them required, they expressed certain conceptions. When it happens this way, there are no misconceptions. Nothing is grasped at. If we really understand this, we will be able to appreciate how and why the words of the Holy Ones have stood the test of time, as we say, and lasted not decades, not centuries, but millennia. Now, they were concerned for our happiness. We are concerned for what we call our happiness. It is related to a self-center. The happiness of the Holy Ones has no relationship to a self-center. The happiness of the Holy Ones is a total reality, not a particular or a finite reality. It is infinite, because it is of the very stuff of creative action, this integrative creative action, which goes on continuously. The creative integrative activity of an energy, a power, which for us is altogether immeasurable and inconceivable. The heart can be moved and can be filled with longing, which is not craving. The Upanishads used a word, they used two words, which are meaningless sounds. Tadvanam, tadjalam. They just made two sounds like that to represent, or rather to symbolize, because the sounds cannot represent, they can symbolize this mysterious, unknown, unknowable, but very real longing of the heart. This longing of the heart was presented in the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad as the love of the ultimate real, karma. They use the word karma for the Atma, of the Atma, in the Atma, through the Atma. Now you see the significance of that. This love is identical with the Atma itself. It is man's way of trying to suggest that type of activity. Just transcendence is not a thing of poverty. It is infinitely rich. It is infinitely capable. It has multitudinous ways. Look at the whole of the universe. No two grains of sand are alike. Look at its variety. Now, in the heart of man, there is this longing. This longing, in its essential inward reality, is a pure thing, utterly pure. But as it emerges through me, wells out through me, it gets misshapen because the demons of self, of craving, of grasping, of fear, and all the rest of it come up and throw mud upon this which is utter purity. If you can sit still, really still, no strains, I'm talking of the body itself, without any strain, and if you can be silent in the real sense, that is, if all the noises of desire and passion and fear and so forth rise up, you just absorb them into your being, and that is the supremely silent state. If you can do that, if you allow it to happen, not strive to bring it about, if you allow it to happen, you will know, you will just know what this love for transcendence means. The theistic religions have talked of the love of God, the love for God, and so forth. But it is the same thing. See, the Buddha, for instance, never fails to emphasize and re-emphasize again and again. Metta, loving kindness. Karuna, compassion. How can I be truly compassionate unless this person, unless the core of selfness, of limited finite selfness in this person has completely dissolved away, and there is no self separate from a non-self? This is something of the nature of the living of the holy life. And the more we become sensitive to it, the more we summon up all our virya, our life force, our energy, our strength, and put the whole of it into it. If you only do that with respect to this inward mystery of the love for transcendence, if we can do that, then we shall know what compassion means and how to be compassionate. How to be compassionate is not a technique. It is not a process. It is a natural state. It is as natural for man, when he is the true human, to be compassionate as it is for water to be wet, or for the sun to shine and spread light. When we developed discriminative consciousness in the course of our evolution, and we began to take sides with pleasure against the disagreeable, and misused our discriminatory faculty and converted our whole consciousness into a purely discriminative consciousness, we denaturalized ourselves. But this had to be. We must not kick against it. This had to be. If transmutation is really to take place, then there must be the death of the old, the complete dissolution of the old, and the death process has its own special pain attached to it, its own special fear and terror attached to it. And similarly, the emergence into the new life, the new birth, so to say, has its own fear and terror and pain attached to it. So, for thousands of years, tens of thousands of years, man in the course of his evolution has been going through this process of pain, fear, terror, experiencing alternately birth, death, birth, death, in order that discriminative consciousness, as we have it today, may come into being, and then it will see its own essential wrongness and sign its own death warrant. But discriminative consciousness of this type has been indispensable for our growth in order that so many intellectual faculties in us, so many powers in us to put ourselves into relationship with what we call the non-self, the not-self, may grow. Of course, we've fallen into the trap of wanting to control and dominate the not-self. We always talk in terms of the conquest of nature and the mastery of resources and nature and so forth. All this had to be in order to realize that in this so-called mastery of nature, this conquest of nature, we are the slaves of our spiritual darkness. And our desires, our craving and grasping directed to ourselves, the self as the central reference point. That's why the human race had to go through it all. Again and again, bear in mind, nothing for the particular individual. There is nothing whatsoever for you or me. As such, we are but cells in the undying body of mankind. And as such, we serve mankind only. And in the serving, we undergo complete transmutation so that we are no longer we. But the new thing that comes into being, the new cell that comes into being in the body of mankind, could not come into being but for oneself. Perhaps, even probably, the time has come in human evolution when release from bondage to our ignorance, our misperceptions, will begin. And insofar as there is release in us as individuals, and we begin to see light, the body of mankind will once again become healthy and see light and be enlightened. But remember what I said earlier, the pain, the fear, and the terror associated with it. Do we not know in our history that the lives of men have been associated with pain all along the line? Look at our history, the history of nations, the history of civilizations. Look at our own little lives. What are they? But this is the way of life in its bigness. And we must have the intelligence. And we must have this heart's longing for the transcendent real, which will enable us to have the power, the stamina, the infinite resilience, the infinite power of absorptiveness, which will take anything and everything into our own being and transmute it as far as lies in our own power, and thereby contribute to the fulfillment of man as man. Now consider the very last words of the Buddha. He says, all component things, all compounded things are perishable. The implication is, don't grasp at compounded things. And then the last two words, appamadena sampadeta. Up means not. Pamadena, with sloth. By means, not by means of sloth. And therefore, for the sake of good English, we translate it positively and say, with diligence, with zeal, sampadeta. Strive on. A better translation, I think, would be, keep going. With diligence, keep going. Isn't it wonderful? The first words of the ministry, when the ministry starts, listen. The deathless has been entered into in perfection. I am expanding it a bit for our sakes. The deathless has been entered into and is being continuously entered into. A continuous process. Here and now you can be the instrument through which the total reality realizes deathlessness. That's at the beginning of the ministry. 45 years go by. He teaches. And at the end, all compounded things subject to death, to dissolution. With diligence, keep going. Note very carefully, there is no message of hope. There is absolutely nothing for me to gain or achieve and attain and stay put. Nothing at all. But if I really can see that, see it alive and vital, then the freedom of the mind is something unbelievable. Because one has totally dropped the load of sorrow, the deep sorrow within. And then whatever comes, pleasure, pain, joy, sorrow, success, failure, as the world talks about these things, it's part of the becoming process. And you are in it. You are totally sensitive to it. But this love longing of the heart for the transcendent real, this intelligence which sees the truth of things as they are, these are so powerful that you have done all the needful in the process of living your life. And that is complete fruition. Because it is the fruition of the whole, of totality, not just of me.